She helped draft No Child Left Behind, and she will tell us why we should now leave it behind. Former Assistant Secretary of Education Diane Ravish joins us, and the president of Chicago Teachers Union, Karen Lewis, provides us with our moment of zen. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker, Dean of Education at Edgewood College, and Dr. Jed Hopkins, Associate Professor of Education at Edgewood College.
Here's what stories are trending in education news.
Number one.
The Education Trust Leadership Council on Civil and Human Rights, Arnie Duncan, U.S. Secretary of Education, are nervous that the anti-testing people are actually starting to make some headway. In fact, they've issued statements of warning of dire consequences that your child, if not tested, will not count. I find that very troubling because the fact is that once your child is tested, your child is no longer human and reduced to data.
So behind all this is this idea that there are two camps. There are those who are for testing and those who are against it. Are there two camps? We definitely know there is a camp that is against the testing. We're in that camp. What's the camp on the other side, though? The protest camp.
According to this, we've got the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council, the Education Trust, the Council of – none of these are grassroots organizations. So these are established, for me, propaganda-pushing bodies. When you tell me that Arnie Duncan and the Department of Education is nervous about the anti-testing crowd, that tells me that the anti-testing crowd is a legitimate grassroots group of people – the people who are making a difference, because for these people who have resources unlimited to be nervous, that's the issue.
Number two.
Teachers in Seattle join the growing movement of teachers refusing to give standardized tests. These teachers in Seattle, like doctors, have decided that they have an oath, do no harm. And that do no harm for them means that they will not be giving standardized tests this year.
There is a moral dimension to this issue, and whenever there is a moral dimension to an issue, there is risk. There is the danger that you may be hurt by taking a stand on your moral position, and here we are. These teachers are actually taking a risk, but it's a worthwhile one.
Think about the risk, too.
It's a real risk.
These teachers have said, and I'm going to name them, Judy Dotson, Becca Ritchie, Susan Dufresne, and Juliana Kruger-Dobble, all from Seattle, have put their jobs on the line because of an act of conscience.
Yeah, I really take my hat off to them. Education is a moral endeavor. We need more of this.
We need more teachers.
Power to them.
Busting pencils.
Absolutely.
Elementary secondary education reauthorization in the news. 1965, this is actually the first time the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was passed, part of Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. This was the entree of the federal government into education at the public level. However, most people know ESEA as
No Child Left Behind. What a potent name for a set of legislation. Yeah. Leave no child behind. I mean, that just tugs at your moral heartstrings, doesn't it?
Quickly.
Yeah.
Since 1965, how many people knew there was such an act until No Child Left Behind?
Yeah.
That's how powerful that name was. Yeah. The idea was, too, that we're going to test every student to figure out what they need so that we can supposedly provide for the deficits that the testing was going to show. One of those people who was part of the original design, Diane Ravitch, says, no, it doesn't work. Okay, so what's at play here right now, Jed, for people watching this is two fundamental issues that they're trying to – do we continue what No Child Left Behind brought in, which is year-round accountability and testing, or do we back away from year-round testing and move into some type of test sampling? That's at stake. Yeah. My point is that if Diane Ravitch, one of the original authors, one of the original people, says we need to stop testing, maybe we might want to listen.
This is a golden opportunity to really reassess, look at the evidence. And there's a lot of evidence. Diane Ravitch has done us a fantastic service of compiling a lot of that evidence.
Book Reign of Error lays it all out.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So, Jed, I'm going to ask you, continue with yearly testing and accountability or try something new?
Try something new. Question testing itself. How about that?
Question accountability.
This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils.
Dr. Diane Ravitch is the author of the best-selling books, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Reign of Error. She's also the author of Diane Ravitch's blog, which has been hit millions of times. And one time long ago, you were also the Assistant Secretary of Education to Lamar Alexander. Welcome, Diane.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
There's a lot that's been going on since The Death and Life. Writing The Death and Life was your realization that No Child Left Behind wasn't working.
That's correct.
And so now, though, we are literally in the process of having hearings where we might reauthorize the Elementary and Education Secondary or Elementary Secondary Education Act, No Child Left Behind, and your former boss, Lamar Alexander, who's now a senator, is heading up the committee that is overseeing this, and you wrote him a letter. What is it that you'd like to see Senator Alexander do?
Well, you know, I'm sure that I won't be completely pleased with whatever comes out of that committee, but what I would love to see happen is to see the entire federal accountability mechanism taken out of the law. I don't think it's the role of the federal government to tell states when and how to test. And in fact, there's legislation. I included that in my letter, my public letter to Lamar Alexander, which, by the way, I haven't gotten an answer. but the purpose of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 was to send additional resources to impoverished districts, districts enrolling large numbers of poor children whose reading performance we knew in 1965 that these kids were not achieving at the level that we wanted them to be, that they were far behind. So the law was intended to redistribute resources. That was its purpose. That should be its purpose today. But over the course of the past 20 years, the federal government has gotten more and more into the testing business. And with No Child Left Behind, it just plunged in head first. What I mentioned in that letter was that the law actually says, and it says it in several places in federal law and has since the 1970s, that no officer of the federal government may attempt to supervise or control or direct curriculum or any program of instruction. Well, Secretary Duncan has been very careful on several occasions to say, I'm not controlling curriculum or instruction. Well, he did underwrite two federal testing consortia for the Common Core, and those tests will control curriculum and instruction. There's no question about that. The Common Core itself, which has been promoted relentlessly by Secretary Duncan, although it's not written into law, nonetheless, he's made it clear he wants everybody to be involved in the Common Core, and he wants these tests to test the Common Core.
This is one of those times, Jed, where I would look around and I scratch my head and say, I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would say.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
What is the Common Core?
That is not so simple. Because it was actually very hard to find out in the beginning. Because the Common Core standards were developed, you could say, somewhat in the back room. They were developed very quickly by two organizations that have really long names. These are multisyllabic names that I can't ever remember, and I don't know who these groups are.
Oh, the Governor's Association.
The Governor's Association.
And the State Association of School Chiefs. And
there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, I don't know who the people are, but I think that they are some consortium of adults who sat in a room and made up these standards. They started with looking at what high school kids should know to be college and career ready,
mm-hmm.
and then they went backwards down to sort of simplify these standards for each grade. But I went carefully over the names, and I'm sorry I never memorized the names of these groups, but they just seem kind of somewhat meaningless to me. But I went over the short bio of each person who participated in these groups, and there wasn't an early childhood educator there.
Right.
There wasn't anyone with early childhood background in any professional capacity or in early childhood background at all, no teachers or early childhood professionals. To answer what are the Common Core standards? Actually, it's a really interesting political question because they were presented very rapidly, developed and presented very rapidly. They were tied to race to the top money. So even though the federal government's not supposed to get involved in, you know, curriculum decisions, that it should be the purview of states, because states wanted race to the top money, they adopted them. States adopted them very, very quickly. So you have more than 40 states. Actually, you had about 45, but some are backpedaling now. Involved with using the exactly same standards, which are very detailed, all across the nation, which raises a lot of concern on many levels. The whole question of whether or not you should have national standards, which these are kind of becoming, is a complicated question and one that really deserves a lot of attention. At what level of detail should they be? Should they exist at all? But the development of these standards wasn't democratic, didn't involve teachers, didn't involve any back-and-forth dialogue or any pilot testing or any mechanism for review and revision that would involve any kind of participation from the education community at large.
So you sound really supportive.
Yeah, so I have worries about them on many levels. It's been very – the adoption of – the pushing of them has been a political matter. It's not a question of whether or not they're really good for education. It's part of the whole ed reform movement and leads people to think that somehow if you have these standards, you're going to improve education. And that's a real diversion from recognizing that our problems in education have to do really with income and wealth inequality and disadvantage for so many children. And you're never going to improve that situation in any significant way by just having standards.
Dr. Nancy Carlson Page, educator, author, emeritus professor, and Matt Damon's mom.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
It's illegal, and it flouts the law. I think that all of the federal accountability program should be gone. I don't expect it to happen, however, because it has huge bipartisan support.
Right.
And as I read the reports from the NCLB hearings, Senator Elizabeth Warren was saying, well, we have to hold – how will we hold schools accountable if we don't test them every year?
Right.
And, you know, she's a hero of the left. How is this happening? Senator Al Franken said, why don't we just give all the kids computer adaptive testing?
Right.
I mean, they can't let go of the idea that the federal government is supposed to test every child every year, and that was never in federal law.
One of the things that comes down into this bill, though, is this issue of around testing. And it seems to be like there's this discussion about, should we be having annual testing, as Elizabeth Warren said we must have because we must have accountability. But then there's this grade span testing idea. And then there's also still the sampling idea of testing, which had always been done with the NAEP. And then just earlier, maybe 15, 20 minutes ago, Dr. Stephen Krashen posted his point, which was, how about no testing until we finally start allocating resources towards the things that actually help kids do better on tests?
You know, my view, and I spoke last night to a couple hundred parents at PS3 in New York City, and I said something that you asked me if I would do years ago, and I said I wouldn't do it, but I said it last night. I said the only way to stop this craziness is to opt your children out, and everybody was very enthusiastic about that, and they broke into workshops to talk about how to take action, but I think that that's the only way it's going to end is when hundreds of thousands of parents opt out their children.
The amount of education that still needs to go on with people, this idea of holding kids accountable. One of the great things Stephen presented at our United Opt Out conference this past weekend was research looking over the sampling of the NAEP. And in fact, you know, if we were worried about the achievement gap, that there was good evidence that between the 70s into the mid 90s that there might have been some gap closing there occurring, and that as soon as accountability gets introduced, the gaps stop closing and even start opening up even bigger in some places. And so the idea that somebody would say, well, we must do testing, Stephen's point at this was to say, why must we do testing when it doesn't tell us anything we don't know?
Well, I agree with him. And, you know, I also pointed out in my letter to Lamar Alexander that every question that people ask is answered by NAEP. if they want to know the scores comparing, and you know, Duncan frequently says, how can we compare the states if we don't have Common Core testing? Well, look at NAEP. They've been comparing states since 1992. How are we going to disaggregate data? NAEP disaggregates data, and they disaggregate it by race, gender, English language proficiency, disability, and a few other counts as well. And then how we know about the achievement gap? We know about the achievement gap from NAEP scores. We don't need any more information. We already have all the information we need. So why are we testing now? Everyone just assumes that testing somehow improves test scores, and there's no evidence for that. That's like saying the more you take your temperature, the better you'll feel, or your temperature will go down if you just keep sticking a thermometer in your mouth.
Yeah, so as far as accountability is concerned, NAEP covers us.
Well, NAEP tells us everything we need to know. If you ask a question, as we frequently do, how will we know? We already know.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, we've known about the achievement gap even before NAEP started testing. We knew about it from the SAT.
I was going to say, that's the one that still drives me crazy, the people that still defend No Child Left Behind, and you hear this in many different ways, but it comes down to something like this. Well, if it wasn't for No Child Left Behind, we wouldn't know about the achievement gap. And nothing is more nonsense than saying that, you know, well, at least there was one good thing, and that was that we got, you know, we've known about the achievement gap. Teachers knew about it before No Child Left Behind. NAEP showed that it was there. As you said, the SAT already showed that it was there. So that's kind of this idea. So doesn't that lead into, though, the public sense of saying, well, yeah, then we must continue to test because we need to close this achievement gap. And if we don't know about the achievement gap, how will we ever close it?
Well, how stupid is that? There were books written about the achievement gap before No Child Left Behind was passed. Brookings published a book, and it was called The Black-White Achievement Gap, and it was a collection of essays on documenting the achievement gap and suggesting ways it might be narrowed. It's not as if we didn't know. Of course we knew, and we've known it since the SAT began publishing data on the different races and how they scored, and I think that was sometime in the 1970s. So there's nothing that we're learning from testing. In fact, what's pathetic is there's nothing that teachers are learning from the testing because, and I don't know what it'll be like or is like in Wisconsin, but in New York, when the kids take the test, the results come back in the summer or the fall,
right,
when they no longer have the same teacher. And then they don't show the teachers what the kids do and don't know. They simply give them a ranking. They say Johnny is a 1, Maria is a 2. So you know that, but you don't know anything about what they need to be helped in. So there's no information on the test that's diagnostic because they want to protect the security of the tests and have it totally non-transparent.
Well, I've said they've treated these tests and the answer sheets and things like this as if there's some state secret that would take down the government if anybody got to know an answer or something like that. But when you apply that and you think about that in teacher ed and teachers, what we know is that, well, that's just bad assessment to not let people see the results of the assessments you're using, to keep it hidden for months. And then when you do show it, is to not tell teachers how the students actually did per item and things like that.
Right.
But I'm still trying to figure out how, from the death and life of the great American school, through Reign of Error, through millions and millions of hits on Diane Ravitch's blog, that we can have somebody like Elizabeth Warren say, well, we still need annual testing. How do we combat that?
Well, you know, what's frustrating to me is I met Elizabeth Warren. I gave her a copy of Reign of Error. She told a friend of mine that she had read it, and I don't know if she's one of the smartest people I've ever met. I was really impressed with how quick-witted she was and how she just, I've met lots of senators and congressmen, and again, she's just really seems to be well-educated, well-informed. I don't understand why she doesn't get the testing piece, because she seems to think that the GOP wants to get rid of testing and that somehow testing is associated with the Obama administration and it's a Democratic idea. Well, the reality is, and I tried to explain that in both of those two books, that what has been the traditional right-wing position has been testing, accountability, and choice. That's the three mantras, testing, accountability, and choice. And the Democrats always stood for equity and also for improving teacher training so that teachers were better prepared and there were higher standards for teaching. But testing was never part of the Democratic agenda. And the Democratic agenda is, frankly, lost, stolen, or strayed.
The book Reign of Error is like a handbook of great arguments. I mean, it's so well sourced. It just floors me why we're still going along this road.
Well, I guess that the people who read it were teachers, and they agreed with it, and I heard from lots of them, people who work in schools, parents, but not politicians. Mm. And, I mean, I think to myself, gee, if only Arne Duncan would read it. But then I think he's such an ideologue, and he's so wedded to his belief in testing. And he has really, I have to say that there are a lot of good things that Obama has done, and I credit him with the two Supreme Court appointments he made, which are just tremendous in terms of the future. But he has made the GOP platform the Democratic platform.
Mm. Right.
I
well,
mean, race at the top is worse than No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, you and I talked about it one time, and I think you said it's like No Child Left Behind on steroids or maybe,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, but
2.0.
And that's a good point to make here is the equal opportunity offenders on both sides of the aisle. This isn't about making schools better for kids. This is about redirecting funding from public schools to other people's wallets and to dismantle the public school system. People say I'm crazy when I make that comment.
No, I know people will say you're crazy, I've heard people, I mean, people have said to me in interviews.
People have told you I'm crazy?
Media. No, people have said, I'm crazy, or I'm harsh, right. Or I'm shrill, or being strident, and there's no evidence that there's any intention to privatize. Well, the evidence is everywhere. And, I mean, almost every day I have something on my blog about yet another charter school where somebody has diverted $1 million into their pocket. And one of the commentators is a big charter advocate, and he writes regularly into the blog to refute. And he'll say, well, look at this story about a principal who stole some money.
Right.
Yeah, what did he steal? $500 out of the kitty? I mean, this other guy transferred $1 million into his bank account. I don't know of any public school where the principal has that kind of money or where the principal or the superintendent is making $600,000 a year like some of the charter leaders are. I mean, there is so much, there are some good charter schools, and in my travels I've met people who say we're really trying to do what charters were set up to do. I also know that there are states that have closed down exactly those charters because they have low test scores because they're taking in the neediest kids. So there's a disincentive to charters to take the kids with disabilities and the kids who don't speak English. But nonetheless, there are some good ones. But in the main, I think that the charter movement is a privatization movement, and it has gotten tremendous support from Wall Street. Not to do the right thing, but to make money, and not necessarily for the hedge fund managers because they're already super rich, but because they believe in the free market. They believe in having a churn of teachers and having inexperienced teachers and having low-wage teachers, and I just don't see how that makes education better if you have inexperienced people who come for 2 years and then leave and who have no background in teacher education. So I think that we're at a point now where we're reaching more and more people. I think that, when you see these stories popping up all over, whether it's in Michigan where the Detroit Free Press spent a week exposing the a lack of accountability and the theft that's going on in the charter sector, and where, you know, in Michigan, 80% of the charter schools operate for profit.
Right.
And then in Pennsylvania, there are four districts now that are under state control, at least one of which is going to be turned over to a for-profit charter chain. And I don't understand if the district is in financial distress, how it's going to be better off if it's turned over to a for-profit company that's going to skim off about 20% of its revenues. Doesn't make any sense. But, you know, the bottom line is, does all of this experimentation with charters, with deregulation, with allowing charters to have, you know, low-wage employees and inexperienced people coming and going, does it make education better? No.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Wanted to set out to improve its educational system would do what we're doing, which is to have lots of vouchers so the kids can go to backwoods religious schools where they teach creationism and to, you know, these storefront schools where inexperienced people are running the schools. This is all nuts.
More from author, activist, and former Assistant Secretary of Education Diane Ravitch on the way. Plus, we will crown our Activist of the Week. tell you how you can get involved in the Busted Pencils world and get a moment of zen from Karen Lewis.
This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils.
Welcome back to Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk. Diane, so back to the reauthorization. We're seeing it right now. What about the possibility of something? Is there something good that can come? Do you see anything good coming out of the reauthorization? Or is this just a show where people are going to come out and make their points, and then we're going to end up with some form of annual testing that keeps us back in the same accountability mode?
Well, I'd say that probably what's going to come out and is going to be in some ways worse than we have now, because it's going to have very, very strong choice provisions, because it's being written by Republicans. And the Republicans want more vouchers, more charter schools, and so we'll see more funding and more authorization of programs to help the privatization movement. And that's not going to be obviously good for public education. I just wrote a post today, which is coming out in a few days, where I tried to show that what's happening in many states is that the charters are draining off resources. Every time a child leaves, the resources leaves with them. So then the public school has to fire teachers, cut programs, cut services, and the end result is that the public school is, because it has so many fixed costs, including more expensive teachers because they're experienced, it ends up always losing the competition, and then an emergency manager comes in, as they did in Michigan and as they are in Pennsylvania, and says, well, why don't we go to an all-charter district? Why don't we have an achievement school district like Tennessee, which is a failing district? Why don't we go like New Orleans, which is a failing district? But that's become the new ALEC conservative mantra. And so the more choice there is, the more public schools are going to be harmed because of those two factors, fixed cost. I mean, how do you compete with a virtual charter school, which has almost no cost at all?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when the kids leave to go to the virtual school, the money goes with them. And so I think that the bill will have much more money and authorization for choice. And I don't know where it's going to go with testing, but it'll either be grade span testing or it will be annual testing. There is no third alternative. I would prefer the third alternative, which is no testing at all, because I don't think that's the federal role and it's not the purpose of ESEA. But, you know, two things happened, which is going to make it even harder. One is that 19 civil rights groups issued a statement supporting annual testing, high-stakes testing, and their statement was incredibly tough-minded, harsh, whatever you want to call it. Only 1% of kids with disabilities could be exempted from the annual high-stakes testing. Now, if you happen to have 15% of your kids with disabilities, only 1% can be. And these will be kids who are really cognitively incapable of taking a test, but there might be more than 1%, and they will have to take the test. And this is coming from civil rights groups. Only among the English language learners, only for 1 year may they be exempted. Now, they're not going to be fluent in English in the second year. We know that it takes anywhere from 5 to 7 years to become fluent. So there will be kids who are failing because they don't speak and read English. We did the Common Core testing in New York now twice, and 97% of the English language learners failed. 95% of the kids with disabilities failed, and more than 80% of black and Hispanic students failed. And yet the civil rights group think that this is somehow a civil right, the right to take those high-stakes tests and fail. And so that, in turn, had a ripple effect on the AFT. The AFT didn't want to be in opposition to the civil rights groups, so they came out with a statement, a compromise statement with the Center for American Progress, which is run by Obama people.
Right.
Carmel Martin and Cindy Brown are very big on high-stakes testing. So the AFT and the Center for American Progress came out with a joint statement saying that they support annual testing without stakes, only for informational purposes, and then grade span testing for accountability. Well, I sincerely believe that every state will continue using the data from the annual test for accountability purpose, no matter what the federal law says, because they're accustomed to doing it. That's their habit. They've been doing it now for, what, almost a dozen years. They're not going to change. As long as they have the data, they will use it for accountability purposes. So, you know, the stuffing got knocked out of the opposition, at least at the political level, and that's why I think that the organizing of parents and educators has to continue. And parents are outraged that their kids have to sit for 8 hours for English language arts test and 8 hours for math test.
Crazy.
I mean, this is more than a law school aptitude test,
right?
Or an LSAT, or the medical test for doctors, the MCATs, or the graduate SATs, or the SAT itself. I mean, why are we subjecting children to hours and hours and hours of testing to find out how they can read and do mathematics? It's crazy.
Well, Diane,
I mean, the question is, how long can you continue insanity without the politicians noticing?
And that's a question that sadly, it seems like we're not getting close to. In one way, I guess, thank goodness for you.
Thank you for the light of sanity that you bring to all of this.
Yeah, the light of sanity, but sadly, I guess, you know, we still have a lot of work to do.
Absolutely.
But one of the things that you just said, parents, listen to Dr. Ravitch, listen to Jed, listen to Tim, listen to us at Busted Pencils. You do have an opportunity to fight back at this simply by saying, I refuse to allow my child to take this test. I opt out. And so, Diane, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Tim and Jed. Nice to talk with you.
Likewise.
And I think just keep people from getting disheartened. And at some point, the boiling point among parents has to – they are the powerful people here. Teachers can lose their jobs. Parents cannot be fired. So I think the parents – it's their children, and they should have the right to opt out, and they should fight for it.
Great advice from Dr. Ravitch. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Bye-bye.
This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils.
We're back. Great discussion with Dr. Diane Ravitch, Jed.
Really great. She always has so many insightful things to say, things that show how connected she is with really what's going on across the country in the political arena. Always worth listening to.
Here's what I like is that she validated that you and I are not crazy.
Yeah, I like that.
You know, I mean, when you think – because we spend – and, you know, come back at this in a serious way, right? You know, we spend so much time talking about the horrors going on in schools, and the people sometimes when they sit down and listen to us, my wife included, you know, people who are in front of us just think, you know, you've either got some kind of wild obsession problem. It can't be that bad is typically what it, you know.
Yeah.
And so people start to get turned off, and we sit in there and go, no, it is that bad.
It is that bad. Well, it's the emperor's magic clothes syndrome, isn't it? I mean, it's so bad that nobody can see it. It's so bad.
Because
I mean, her arguments are cogent. I love what she said about breaking the law, the federal laws, about the role of the feds in managing an education system.
Well, yeah, think about that, right? The history there was that the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is what we talked about mostly in the reauthorization, was never an accountability act.
Yeah.
It was purely put in place because it recognized one of the things that the states couldn't do, and that was equitably fund education. And so, therefore, let's have a mechanism to make sure that we level the playing field.
Yeah.
How is it that we went from that idea to now testing children, as we've heard now, 8 hours?
Yeah.
8 hours?
Yeah.
Longer than a medical test?
Yeah.
That's what the Department of Education is now enforcing?
Right.
And as Diane said, here's the other thing, though, what you
federally
just said.
Federally mandated child abuse.
Yeah. Okay. So not – we know child abuse is illegal, but Diane points out that this whole federal intrusion itself is illegal, but yet we keep doing it.
I know.
How do we stop it?
And then someone like Elizabeth Warren just still doesn't seem to get it.
No. As I said, equal opportunity offenders on both sides of the aisle. Let's give Elizabeth Warren the benefit of the doubt. She's a good progressive, typically gets it, right? On this one, somehow she just doesn't get it. I don't buy that.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't buy that Elizabeth Warren, as smart as she is, as Diane pointed out, as quick-witted as she is, that there's no way that she can't, after being given the book or looking at these arguments, how someone that smart, a senator, could then come back and make a statement such as, how will we ever know how students are doing if we don't hold teachers and schools accountable?
I want to talk to her. I want to have her on the program.
I want to have her on for a much longer. I mean, we've got 1 minute left where we obviously could not do enough time, because I'm getting ready to look out there to Kurt, our engineer and producer, and say, Kurt, look, man, call Elizabeth Warren up right now because Jed and I need to talk to her. You know, but we, you know, with the 45 seconds, he's doing it right now. You know, with the 45 seconds we have left, though, Jed, I mean, you know, this is the great thing, though. If we're going to bust pencils, which is what this show is about.
Right on.
People need to listen to what Dr. Diane Ravitch is
saying.
And
they should read her letter.
Read her letter to Lamar Alexander. Yeah. You know what I thought, though?
Yeah.
It was really powerful.
Yeah.
Is when she said, if there's a solution. She didn't say annual testing. She didn't say sampling. She actually said, no more testing.
Yeah.
That's pretty powerful stuff coming from her. And in fact, a lot of people would say, what?
Yeah.
What would it look like, Jed? And I asked this question to the listener of the Busted Pencils radio show. What if we did no testing?
This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils.
We're back, and this is one of our best segments, Jed. This is where we introduce our activist of the week, that one person out there that's doing something, busting pencils, as you will say. And this week, we are lucky to have Mom Michelle, Activist of the Week. You're out there doing something pretty spectacular. Your kids do something that a lot of kids don't do. Your kids do not take standardized tests in schools. They opt out. They refuse. They don't do it. That obviously had to come from Mom. Why?
Because we need to support the public school teachers.
What makes you say, my son is not taking a test?
The pain I see in the schools.
Why does this make you so upset?
Because these tests are meaningless to the kids. It doesn't affect their grade. It doesn't affect their school. They lose money on the tests, millions of dollars, and it hurts their teacher. People are being fired over a test that doesn't matter.
Educationally doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's a shame these kids are being used. My kid is not a test score, and they can't be used for profit. And these tests make a profit. It's not for the kid. It's not to help a teacher teach in the classroom. It's to help shut down the schools so they could bring in the charter schools and make money. It's a shame.
Michelle, how long have you been opting out your child from, or your children from?
This will be the fifth year. And luckily, it's gotten easier. But first year was tricky.
Yeah, well, so the first year you do it, I mean, what happened?
We were the only ones to opt out, and there was another child that at the last minute decided to opt out with us. But
what do you do? I mean, how do you make a decision? Obviously,
you know what I did? I made sure that I had the school system behind me, right, at least within the school, the teachers and the principal, and to know that my kid wasn't going to be a pawn in the process, because that wasn't the goal. Somebody had to stand up and say something for these teachers.
So clearly you have very, I'm going to say, honorable reasons for doing this.
Yes, thank you.
I mean, that's just clear to me, you know, and I'm sure it's going to be clear to a lot of people, but what's it like? Has it been very burdensome on you?
No, it's been rewarding and extremely easy. And the teachers light up. Their hands are tied, and they will lose their jobs. Mm. They will. And so they can't talk. They can't say anything about it. They just know that it's wrong within the schools. The schools are really sad when test time comes around. And it's not the interactive environment that it's supposed to be. Mm. And it's because of the standardized test solely. No other reason. It's not because teachers are bad. It's not because they don't know what they're doing. They're not allowed to teach in the classrooms. And on top of it, they're being forced to do these tests that take away their job.
What happens to your kid during opt-out?
My kid gets patted on the back. He gets lifted up by his peers.
Because a parent right now out there is saying, okay, what will my kid go through if they opt out?
Your child will probably be put in the library and get to pick out books that they want to read, or finish a project that they want to finish, or get an additional project that's something of interest to them.
So over the 4 years that you've been opting your children out, there has not been harassment, ill will, do you think?
My children have never been negatively affected. If nothing else, they've been lifted up, you know, kind of celebrated, because they're not having to sit there and be a drone to a test that they find out doesn't affect their grade whatsoever. It's not teaching them anything except how to hit a button on the computer. Now I guess it's the computer screens. Before that was filling in the bubble sheets.
Do you play?
And I've seen this directly within the school because I worked in the school as a paraprofessional.
Do you plan on doing this again?
Yeah, absolutely, until they graduate out of school because...
You know, Michelle, I always end this segment with this, but I always mean it, but I'm meaning it again. You are busting pencils.
Right, thank you.
Nominate your choice for Education Activist of the Week now at bustedpencils.com.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker, Dean of Education at Edgewood College, and Dr. Jed Hopkins, Associate Professor of Education at Edgewood College.
Very privileged because we have an absolutely special guest. Actually, two special guests. Kirsten Lombard. Kirsten is the founder, owner, CEO of Resounding Books and the editor, the first book to come out of Resounding Books, Common Ground on the Common Core, Voices from Across the Political Spectrum Expose the Realities of the Common Core State Standards. Kirsten, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim. It's delightful to be here.
Quick little snippet. What are we going to find out about in this book?
Well, you're certainly going to find out a lot about the various dangers that Common Core poses to a lot of different populations, from students and teachers all the way to parents and taxpayers. But I think one of the most unique things about this book, the thing that separates it from anything else out there right now that is being sold, any books or whatever that are being sold on Common Core, is that it literally combines voices from across the political spectrum. Talks about things from a number of different perspectives. We very carefully edited the book to ensure that literally anybody could pick it up, mm-hmm. anybody could use it to educate themselves without being turned off, and anybody could then hand it to other people without fearing that somebody would be turned off by it.
You yourself would classify, these labels I think actually do more damage most of the time because they really pigeonhole us into a certain thing. But
right.
but you tend to be more of, and I like to say, a libertarian.
I'd say a small L libertarian.
Small L libertarian, right?
Yes.
Okay, unlike a small L liberal like me.
Right.
Like people who would say you're a liberal. But you also managed to find another small L or big L. I'm going to get there. Small L. We've got freedom-loving Jeff. Jeff, you're also a small L libertarian and an author of one of the chapters in this book, correct?
That's correct.
Welcome.
Welcome. It's great to be here. I'm really excited about this book. I think it strikes a real blow for freedom, and I love that. So that's why I'm here.
Jed, freedom.
Yeah. Well,
liberty, freedom and liberty. Do we need to talk anymore? I think
I feel like I'm in the United States of America.
You should feel like that, you know. So you and I also authored one of the chapters in this book.
We like freedom and liberty too.
We like freedom and liberty too, and we would probably be small L, big L, I don't know, liberals talking to small L libertarians, but we're all together. Kirsten, here it is right here at the table. Is an example of the book. I mean, why Common Ground?
Well, as somebody who's worked in the grassroots in the state of Wisconsin for the last 5 years, the last two of those years have been dedicated almost exclusively to watching what's coming down the track in terms of education policy in the state of Wisconsin and really across the nation. And when we started to see what was happening with Common Core out in the state of New York, for example, and other places, a few other places where full implementation of Common Core happened early, we started trying to warn legislators here, citizens, and what we found after fighting for 2 years is that we could get a fair number of conservative and libertarian-minded grassroots folks really active on the issue, really understanding what was going on, but we could not get anybody up at the Capitol to really hear us, except for maybe a very small handful of Republican legislators teachers, but nobody with the spine to really, you know, move anything forward. Leadership in this state at the state level is really, really pretty committed to plowing forward with Common Core. So it started to become clear to me that if we were going to get anywhere, we needed to accomplish some kind of critical mass, and that wasn't going to happen if it was just us, you know, talking to ourselves. We needed to start talking to people that, you know, we weren't accustomed to talking with.
Yeah,
I mean, the likes of us.
That's correct.
I was going to say. But here on the Common Core, I mean, you found something unique.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, you and Jed were some of the first people that I would say the first people that Jeff and I spoke with in this area who were not from our normal circles, who we actually found true common ground with. And it was amazing. I'm sure you all remember hearing that, oh, you know, maybe you should sit down with Kirsten, you know, maybe you should sit down with Tim. Those kinds of things started to be whispered to us. And, you know, Jeff and I finally said, well, hey, we'll sit down with anybody. And we all had coffee together.
Jed and I will not usually sit down with anybody.
So. Yeah. And I think probably it was you, Tim, and Jeff and I the first time we met. And I think that probably all of us were a little skeptical about, you know, what could or could not happen at that first meeting. But by the end of a couple of hours of discussion, it was very clear, I think, to Jeff and I think to you as well, that not only was there common ground, but we liked each other personally, that, you know, we had a lot to talk about, that we shared a lot of ideas about what education should and shouldn't be, what teachers should and shouldn't be able to do in the classroom, how parents should be involved in education. A whole lot of things. And So it was very exciting for us.
Freedom-loving Jeff. You wrote to me one of the most interesting and powerful chapters, I think, in this book. If somebody would have given me your chapter and not told me anything and I would have read it, I would have went, obviously a liberal. Uh-oh, look at that face.
Well, what sort of hit a note with me is both Governor Walker, and you hear other politicians talk about it too, they're always hammering on preparing kids for the jobs of the future. And so I thought about that a bit, why we're preparing kids for these jobs of the future and what those jobs really entail. And I started doing some research into the funding behind Common Core and a lot of the testing solutions and things like that, and found out a lot of it is big corporations. You know, Walmart, Amazon, Microsoft, we've heard about a lot of them. And a lot of these jobs that they're looking to fill are really low-level mechanized jobs that they want people that are, A, willing to be surveilled, and B, willing to shut up and not ask a lot of questions. They're being conditioned to be that being watched and being judged is a normal thing at work. You've got big business and big government together to essentially, you know what we call that, whether you're libertarian or liberal, when
I know what you're
going to
call it, but go ahead.
Yeah, we call that fascism.
Oh my God.
That's what we're on the road to.
You just heard it right here, first time on Busted Pencils, fascism. From Jed and I, we both want to say thank you. I appreciate meeting the two of you and over the year getting to know the two of you. Kirsten Lombard, founder, editor, CEO, Resounding Books, Common Ground, Common Core. Where can we get the book?
You can purchase the book on the Resounding Books website, which is resoundingbooks.org. That's the place to go to get it, resoundingbooks.org. It's only available in print right now, but within the next week or two, we expect to have a digital version that will work on Kindle as well.
Thank you so much for being on Busted Pencils, and can't wait to talk to you again someday.
We look forward to it.
Terrific.
It's now time for Busted Pencils' Moment of Zen. Howard Zinn wrote A People's History of the United States in 1980. He spent his life as an advocate for the voiceless. We end every show with a tribute to Howard Zinn. This week, Busted Pencils is honored to have Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis as our voice. This passage from a Howard Zinn speech seems to encompass Karen's personal experience, but also inspires us to continue the fight for justice. Busted Pencils' Moment of Zen.
The challenge remains. On the other side are formidable forces, money, political power, the major media. On our side are the people of the world and a power greater than money or weapons, the truth. Truth has a power of its own. Art has a power of its own. That age-old lesson that everything we do matters is the meaning of the people's struggle here in the United States and everywhere. A poem can inspire a movement. A pamphlet can spark a revolution. Civil disobedience can arouse people and provoke us to think. When we organize with one another, when we get involved, when we stand up and speak out together, we can create a power no government can suppress. We live in a beautiful country, but people who have no respect for human life, freedom, or justice have taken it over. It is now up to all of us to take it back.
Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis. Looking for busted pencils? Well, get out of your desk and make sure you go to facebook.com/bustedpencils or check us out on Twitter at Busted Pencils. Make sure you follow us on the web at bustedpencils.com. Thanks for listening.